Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Recently, I've been sharing information about the importance of eye contact to mental health. In this episode, I will be discussing what happens when you introduce a horse to the therapy session. I'm going to share how you can assess eye contact in the first encounter and use this information to inform your treatment plan. What I'm about to share works for all modalities, because what we are discussing here is such a fundamental behavior, it shows up in the initial encounter and all throughout treatment. And it is most easily demonstrated when working with horses in equine-assisted services, so I'm going to describe it from that perspective. I'm going to explain what you are looking for in the introduction to the horse and how to use that information to inform your treatment plan. In order to get started, let's remember what we learned when we first started talking about the importance of eye contact. A lot of the ways I began to recognize the importance of eye contact was by learning more about our animal counterparts, and in this case, how eye contact works in one species and then between species. We learned earlier from Mark Beckoff, who observed the behavior of eye contact in wolves and domesticated dogs, that making eye contact during play seemed important to continue, signaling that the play intent was still there from one dog to the other. In other words, that it hadn't escalated beyond play. They use eye contact to stay in communication about that intent. Then there were the eye contact experiences as referenced by divers near the Pacific coast who encountered whales. It was a common refrain from those explanations about their experiences that to make eye contact with a whale is to realize there is someone sentient on the other side of that gaze. And of course, Jane Goodall's experiences with the chimpanzees were important. And she noted the difference in the chimpanzee's ability to tolerate and maybe even welcome eye contact, whereas for baboons, it is considered a move toward aggression. There seems to be an interspecies interest in eye contact, and in all these cases, eye contact has meaning associated with it. Sometimes difficult to discern across species, perhaps, but messages are being conveyed. This is most easily seen by observing the occipital lobe, that upper half of the eye socket, above the eyes and below the eyebrows. This facial feature is common to mammals, and we share information quickly via this lobe. A lot of the eye contact here is so quick, it is hard to be aware of it until you take a moment to notice, and when you do, you start to be able to track patterns, such that when the eyelids are raised so high you can see white above the pupils, that is generally an indication that someone is on alert. It is not always that an alert is a bad thing. At first, it's just a reaction to a new thing. Then the person, if we are considering humans, will look to someone else in the social group to determine if this is safe or not. Children typically look to their caregivers, and as we discussed in the last episode, our patients will begin to look at us for support in these circumstances when something unexpected happens in session, like a loud noise, for example. And so in the last episode, I shared about how to make assessments based on the eye movement patterns you see. You're watching to see the patient's eye contact when a new or unexpected thing happens in your in-office session. Now let's think about the introduction to the horse. One advantage of working in a barn is that there are all kinds of things that happen that are new and unexpected. So in greeting the horse for the first time, you can obtain a lot of information on how your patient is going to work with you. And now we've got another pair of eyes to reference, those of the horse working with us. Horses can see approximately 170 degrees out of each eye. That means 340 degrees in total. So standing still, they can almost see completely in a circle around them. The advantage here for therapeutic work is that to the participant, it can feel like the horse is looking at them, because they are. The horse is just usually taking in the whole scene, including the participant. Horses do not make eye contact always like humans do, and this can be confusing for the new participant. In working in equine-assisted services in a couple different areas, I've had this explained to me by different horse specialists, and essentially the thinking is, horses, by nature, are prey animals. Even though we ask them to live with us as humans and we do not have an intention to eat them, they live by the rules of survival for prey animals, and this means that by nature, they are wary of things, including humans. Because humans, by nature, are predator animals. While they will glance in the direction of the new participant, there's not usually that connected gaze, especially at first. Horses just don't seem to enjoy a long gaze with a smile associated as much as humans do. I'm going to introduce the work of Jaak Panksepp here, a pioneer in the field he named affective neuroscience. He did a lot of work uncovering the ancestral roots of many of our human emotions and behaviors. In the work, The Archaeology of Mind, Neuroevolutionary Origins of Human Emotions, that he co-authored with Lucy Bivin, a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, they explain 7 systems that motivate most animals. They include joy, panic, aggression, and others which I will discuss in a later episode. Essentially, the idea is that there's a variety of systems that motivate what most mammals do, and they categorize them into 7 different systems. One of the systems they describe is the seeking system, how the brain generates a euphoric and expectant response. It is defined by a wide variety of behaviors and even identified with neurochemicals in the blood. And it is activated, in other words, the system comes online and gets activated, and we start to see some of those behaviors and neurochemicals form in the blood when the mammal is searching for something. Maybe food, maybe housing. For humans, maybe a big sale at Amazon. You get the idea. When that seeking system starts, you can kind of sense it, right? You can think about what it's like to seek something yourself, and you're looking for it and you're excited. That's what's defined in this idea as the seeking system. And it relates to the idea we're talking about right now, because they describe that when predator animals are hunting for food, it is not the aggression system that is activated, as one might expect. Instead, it is the seeking system. And this is how I've been making sense of the horse's experience when we come into the barn and want something from them. Even though our intention is not to harm or be aggressive with them, that is, we do what we think of as non-predatory behavior, but we still want something, and thus our seeking system is activated. And the horses recognize this as being congruent with what predators do. In this episode, we're talking a lot about nonverbals, and horses can read them very well, and they can read them very well in humans. So even though our intentions are not to be a predator, we're doing what predators do, and the seeking system is activated in us, and horses can sense that. This idea from Panksepp is really helpful because in my experience, this is one of the most painful things for a new participant to equine-assisted services, is if they've been looking forward to the appointment and meeting their new horse, there's a real longing quality, and I believe the seeking energy gets activated, and I'm not quite sure how it all works just yet, but I do know from working in the field and my own experiences with horses, when we want something, like really badly want something from them, they are able to sense it and generally want no part of it. You hear advice a lot as a horse person to slow down and not get in a hurry when you're asking a horse to do something. And that applies here. And I feel it extends to our notions of making connections with horses. They are social creatures too, so typically they also want to connect with us. But this to me is one of the most powerful things about working therapeutically with horses, is we have to start to realize they are their own being and even another species. So they have different needs and agendas to us, and it needs to be a co-created partnership when we go out to the barn. I'm going into detail here for a few reasons. The first is to set the scene so you can imagine how this works. Another is to underscore the point that animals working in therapy with us have their own needs and preferences. We cannot ask them to work alongside of us and not be aware of these differences and respect them. It is a natural human need, as I have been discussing in recent episodes, to seek eye contact. Yet for horses, it can activate an alert response. And for some dogs, it can be a bid for dominance, which would lead toward aggression. So as therapists working in these ways, it is incumbent on us to understand the innate needs of humans as well as animals. Okay, now let's explore how we can observe eye contact in the participant to help inform next steps in the treatment. Let me give some examples to illustrate how this may work, and here I'm going to follow the terminology of the Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship International. This organization goes by the acronym PATH, and they set standards for equine-assisted services. And in PATH, the patient is called the participant, and so that is the way I will refer to them from here on out. Let's imagine two different child participants, and I'll walk through each scenario. Often in working with children, there is usually a barn tour first, before treatment starts, that involves their caregiver walking through and greeting horses together with the child participant. So I am giving the tour, and let's say I stop by the stall that has a draft horse in it. Some examples of draft horses are Clydesdales and Belgians. These horses tend to be about 18 hands tall. That is a way to measure the height of horses, and it means that at their shoulders, they are often close to 6 feet tall. And that means up to their ears, they're about 8 feet tall. They usually weigh about 2,000 pounds. So we definitely have the new novel experience in greeting a horse of this size. And it is very common for someone's eyes to get wide in this situation. So it provides plenty of opportunity to understand more about the participant. So now we want to observe how the child responds to meeting this horse. This experience is similar to the strange situation experiment by Dr. Mary Ainsworth. Do you recognize it? The strange situation is that experiment where the terms securely attached, anxiously attached, and so on come from. And the setup is that an infant and their caregiver are in a room when a stranger enters. There are some other pieces to it, but essentially the data in the experiment is derived from observing the behaviors made by the infant toward its caregiver. I discussed this in detail in episode 3, and I'll summarize the key points in this case. You have a child, their caregiver, and a huge stranger. And you can learn a lot by observing the interactions between them. And I'm going to extend the observations to include how they interact with me as a therapist too. Generally, when someone greets a Clydesdale, there is the initial awareness of their enormity. In my experience, they are gentle giants, but it is inescapable how giant they are. To be near them evokes a lot of feelings, and typically people start saying all kinds of things, some of them projections, as has been discussed earlier in the podcast, and some of them just basic facts, such as maybe the caregiver remarks, "This horse is so big!" And the participant agrees and notices the horse's feet and says, "Look at those big feet!" One thing I've learned is that if you want to assist someone in regulating emotion, it helps to return the affect, the feelings and the emotions, that is, in a similar range. At this point, I usually endorse the observations and the tone of them. "Yep, he's got big feet." And Clydesdales do have huge feet. Hooves, they're called. And for a draft horse, they're about the size of a plate. Massive. So in terms of what we're going to assess in the intake session, the first is the initial responses to the horse. Is the participant displaying the experience of surprise with wide eyes and a slight gasp? Where do her eyes go from there? If she is comfortable getting support from her caregiver, her eyes will usually go there first. Then, after meeting the child's eyes, the caregiver's eyes will usually come to meet mine. It is the idea of expectation. The participant is kind of asking, "You sure about this, Mom?" And the caregiver is looking at me, thinking, "I think so. And what do you think? Is this a good idea?" After this first nonverbal check-in, things should calm a bit. And ideally now the eye contact turns toward the horse. And I'm watching to see if she is attentive to the horse. Is she curious about him? I'm looking for things like blinks and downward gazes to see how she is able to moderate her reactions. And then usually right when someone takes a few deep breaths and calms down, the horse will do something unexpected. Horses are great for doing unexpected things, so there will be lots of opportunities for the assessment of how the participant seeks support, or if they do not seek support, and understanding how to be around the horse. There will be things like snorts, and in the summer you see a lot of stomping feet. Stomping feet can easily be misunderstood as frustration, but during the summer it is usually flies on the horse's legs. I'm watching the eye movements of the participant, looking for her occipital lobe and trying to determine how surprised or shocked she is at these unexpected horse behaviors. If the horse does stomp, almost all participants will look you directly in the eye when he does for the first time. Especially with the hoof size I just mentioned, it can be dangerous to be near a horse when he's stomping. So it's a healthy response if the participant looks directly at me and expects me to either do something or explain the stomps. Maybe she says something like, "He stomped his feet!" And I write, so in this case, I would raise my eyes and my voice higher than I actually feel, since I am used to horses doing this when I return the gaze, and I might say something like, "He stomped his foot. I think he probably has some flies on his legs. He was trying to shake them off." In future episodes, I'm going to talk about voice, but you can hear there what my eyes are doing. Starting high and then going lower. I don't think it's an official term, but I call it picking up. I'm going to pick up her eye contact at that higher level and role model what it is like to bring my eyes and by extension my emotional intensity down a few notches. And I'm curious if she can follow me in doing a similar behavior. Most participants get more aware of flies at this point, and they start looking for them on the horse, and some may try to help the horse or worry about him. It is very natural and expected that you would see an increased blink rate here. It is just anxiety provoking to have a horse you just met start stomping next to you. And I'm just continually observing. When she sees or hears things unexpectedly, like the stomps, is she checking in with her caregiver and then checking in with me by making eye contact? And in this example, we are seeing her do that, displaying some of those natural and appropriate responses of alert and alarm, and then being able to relax a bit when her caregiver and myself role model that that's okay to do. When meeting a large draft horse, as in this example, these are all typical behaviors. And so far, to me, the participant's behavior suggests she is a strong candidate for equine-assisted services, meaning the services could really help her. She was looking to her caregiver for reassurance at the beginning, following the lead of her caregiver's trust in me. She has now extended that eye contact to me when unexpected things happen. She displayed an appropriate, surprised, and slightly anxious response to stomping, which tells me she is approaching unexpected situations with a good amount of balance between awareness and caution. Depending on her presenting needs, insight building, and or relational skills interventions would likely be the place to start. Her behaviors in response to the horse, as an example here trying to get rid of the flies, are a great place to start because I could see a whole discussion about what happens when we cannot get rid of things that bother us. What do the horses do? What do we do? Working with horses is fantastic, in my experience, because there are so many ways to relate and explore. Yet, since this episode is focused on the initial greeting, I'll offer another example when some things need to happen before working with the horse therapeutically. Let's imagine another participant. Similar setup. Caregiver and participant are introduced to me, then introduced to the same horse. The horse, as we mentioned, is huge. So if at this point the participant is not making eye contact with either me or his caregiver, and instead looking down, for example, this suggests he is not attentive to the horse, me, or his caregiver. In psychology, we observe this to be where the affect, the emotions, are not matching the content and the environment. In other words, the horse is huge, he's hard to miss, and he's doing unexpected things like stomping his huge hoofs. Myself and his caregiver are in an alert and aware mode, supporting the interaction, while being aware of the need for safety. If a participant can stand next to him and not display emotions, and their emotional stance is flat, and eye contact is not being made, that is distinct. And if I do not see any other nonverbal signals that would indicate he is tracking what I am saying without eye contact, then I would want to learn a lot more about this participant before going too much further with equine-assisted activities. The reason for this is that being around horses requires the participant to be able to stay in communication with adults like their caregiver and professionals like myself at the barn. And we need him to be able to follow the guidance as to how to act near the horse. If the participant is consistently not making eye contact, it is hard to tell if he will be able to hear, understand, and follow any guidance he might need to receive. And this ability needs to be in place consistently before interventions can start to take place with the horse. For me, I would want to begin with those reciprocal play activities that I mentioned in an earlier episode first, and probably with the human therapist to start, to understand more about if his behaviors are specific to environment or person when he displays them. One more thing to note. Much like we need to start learning about eye contact preferences in other species, specifically any animals we ask to work therapeutically with us, we also need to start being curious about eye contact preferences within our own species. Eye contact behaviors can vary by upbringing, by culture, and many other factors. There are many people for whom eye contact is not comfortable. When I've heard Dr. Temple Grandin speak, she is an expert both in animal behavior and autism. She has mentioned there being differences in preference and behaviors of eye contact for people on the autistic spectrum. And it's not to say if someone doesn't make eye contact that they are not a good candidate for working with horses. In fact, they could be a great candidate and really receive a lot of benefits in working with horses. I was using that example to illustrate the non-communicative nature of participant two, where we need to start supporting his ability to relate before bringing him into the barn. And specifically ensuring that bond is there therapeutically, where when he needs support, he will seek it from a safe adult in the barn. And when the professionals need to ask him to do something or not do something near the horse, we need to be fairly certain he can hear, receive, and respond to that guidance. One reason I feel it is helpful to distinguish behaviors in this way is to support us in learning how interactions with the horse are more than therapeutic. They are diagnostic. Learning to decipher the indications of behaviors toward and with the horse is paramount to successful treatment because we get more information about what needs to be addressed and we can now put some format to our instinctual responses. In this second example, most barn managers would know that this participant is likely not ready for services to start. Most people would sense that something is dangerous about the way he is reacting to the horse, which in the example I listed is mostly that he's not reacting to the horse. In other words, he's emotionally flat and unresponsive to this huge horse standing right next to him. At the moment, in the field of equine-assisted services, and maybe even in the field of psychology, behaviors like this are typically under the category of not safe. And then participants are asked to do something that is safe. And what I'm hoping to do in this podcast and in these explorations is to start giving us some words and ways to speak about what it means to say these are not safe and how we can decipher these behaviors in order to support the participant in developing ways to relate that would make it more safe for them, in this case, to interact in the barn with a Clydesdale horse. Thankfully, there are many ways to relate non-verbally that we will continue to explore in this podcast. In fact, I hope you are beginning to realize we already communicate non-verbally in so many ways, many of which science doesn't even fully understand yet. So, good news, many more things for us to explore here together. Thanks for joining me. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time. Somewhere between 20 and 60% of mental health professionals endorse feeling burned out in our field. This is from a study published by the National Institutes of Health. The reason the range is so wide is because it's difficult to determine what it means to be burned out. But when you feel it, you know it. If this is happening to you and you'd like to join a community of supportive colleagues, then please consider joining our Connection Community. In it, we're going to follow up on the topics presented here in the podcast, and we're going to talk about how they can apply to your work. My impression is that to sustain in the field of mental health, it's important to feel like what we're doing has an impact and that we're not alone in it. And that's my intent with the Connection Community, and I hope you'll consider joining us. You can find more information on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, or by emailing us at member@connectiontherapypodcast.com for more information. Thanks.